Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's February 17, 2017 program, Finding True North on eWeb's campus, U.S. Present and Future. Our guest speaker will be Frank Lawson, and we also welcome Janine Parizzi as a visitor in support. We also have an elected member of the eWeb board. Welcome you as well. My name is Juan Carlos Valle. I'm a City Club board president. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported organization, which is a nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence in public policy. They have access to those, and obviously they come every Friday. And after-hours programs, too. If you want to become a member, it's very easy to do. Go to www.cityclubofeugene.org. And if you want to become a volunteer, we are looking for volunteers all the time, so keep that in mind. Today's program is coordinated by Sandra Bishop. And Sandra, why don't I just have you come out and introduce our guest speaker? Please welcome Sandra Minor.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's my privilege today to introduce our speaker. We're very lucky here in Eugene. eWeb, Eugene Water and Electric Board, is the largest public municipal utility in the state, and we're very lucky to have Mr. Frank Lawson here today as our speaker. I also want to take note that we also have a couple of former, actually there's three of us who are former eWeb commissioners. Camilla and also Bob, could you please stand? Three of us are former eWeb commissioners. We also have with us a former Emerald People's Utility District Commissioner, Catherine Chott. Would you please stand? And we have a current eWeb Board of Directors, Mr. Dick Huggison. Public power is an epic part of the ethos of the state of Oregon. We only have about six PUDs, but they have been very active and have oftentimes taken over and taken territory away from utilities that were basically driving prices up through private enterprise. So it's very good that we have eWeb here in Eugene. So to say a little bit about Frank came to work at eWeb in 2010, and he came in as the electric systems engineering supervisor. And he, along with his advanced degrees, he is also a graduate of South Eugene. And so he's coming home. One of the reasons that brought him back to apply for that job at eWeb and obtain that position was to be close to his father, so he and his family settled here. So since 2010, Frank's been working internally in the utility, and then last year in May or so, the Board of Directors, eWeb Board, wisely decided to promote Frank into the general manager position. And he has a very interesting background. He has more than 25 years of both technical experience as an engineer, working with technology, and also in marketing, which is a rather unusual combination to have. One of the things that sets Frank apart from other utility managers is that he comes into the job being able to communicate with everyone from the line worker to the management staff up to the elected board and the customers. So that's much appreciated. He's also coming into a 100-year-old culture at a time of great change. There's a lot of challenges in the electric industry these days, and there's also challenges in the employee base of that industry. So it's my pleasure and honor today to introduce our speaker. Frank has the foresight and fortitude to lead eWeb into the future. So Frank, please come forward. Thank you.
So thank you, good afternoon. I have to tell you, I am proud to be a Eugenian. It's something that I think back through my history. I grew up in the shadows of Amazon Park. We had a beautiful pool in Amazon Park, but that's not where I spent my time. I actually swam in the creek, which might explain a few things to you. In fact, we didn't even call it a creek back then. We called it a slough, if I remember right. It was really a great time to grow up. I also have to be a little bit truthful as to why I ended up back in Eugene, and more specifically why I ended up at EWEB. I was visiting my father. My mother had passed away, and he mentioned what his power bill was. And I have to tell you, my first reaction was started with holy and ended with it, because I thought, wow, this is a very expensive bill. And so he lived in the same house that I grew up in. So it was 1,200 square feet. It had single pane windows, baseboard heat. So some of that explained it. But I had this reason to go on the EWEB website and look up the rates. And lo and behold, when I was looking up the rates, I saw this position that was advertised for systems engineering supervisor. And being curious, I was really interested more than anything in getting closer to my father and getting back to the community that I grew up in. And so I actually applied for the position. It sounded pretty interesting to me. And about 4 months later, I got the job. So I ended up back in Eugene where I had started. I was born in Sacred Heart Hospital, and my dad still lives in the house that I grew up in. It's like walking back into a time warp, I tell you. It's the same fixtures are there, the ones that worked and the ones that didn't. It was really a fun opportunity to come back to Eugene. I will tell you also, just for context, I'm not a utility lifer, as I describe it. In the utility industry, we tend to have our own language. We talk in utility, as I call it. And really part of my job is to take utility speak and turn it into normal person speak, because most people don't understand the intricacies of how we operate. Not being a utility lifer, I tend to bring a different view as to what the utility should do and how competitive the utility should be. And so some of that will give you a little bit of context as I go through this. But ultimately, I'm really glad to be back in Eugene and contribute to the community in this position. So big picture trends, kind of run through this quickly. The utility industry, like a lot of other industries, is under pressure from a number of different areas. There's technology pressures, there's market pressures. When the board asked me during the interview process what I thought the largest challenges for the utility was, there's a couple things that naturally came to mind, and I didn't want them to know that I wasn't thinking about these things. So I talked about cybersecurity. I talked about the fact that markets are changing. I talked about the scarcity and the importance of water, and the fact that water in many parts of the country is the currency of the future that we need to protect. And I talked about all those things, but I also talked about something else. I talked about one of the largest challenges that a utility faces is the fact that we have too many good choices. And at some point as a utility, you have to decide what you're going to be good at, and you decide what you're going to be really good at, and that's what you focus on. And when there's lots of distractions, you can end up deluding yourself to the point where you don't do anything very well. And we have to be very careful with that, because we are a utility that has a lot of distractions. And so part of our direction and our change, and much of it's cultural, has to do with focus. And so while you see trends, and there are market trends, and we'll talk about some of those as we go through this, one of the things that we have to be very careful about is that there are lots of good opportunities out there, and we really have to concentrate and understand what we can be good at and how we get there. When you think about EWEB, a lot of times as customers, we think about one utility. But in many cases, we have two utilities, and they are strategically challenged slightly differently. On the water utility, we are blessed with a beautiful water source. The McKenzie River, both in quality and quantity, is a great natural resource. I grew up on the McKenzie. I remember my parents telling me how wonderful the water here was. I would never experience water like this anywhere else in the world. In fact, I think they said universe. I'm not sure how they knew that. But they just drove it into my head that this is absolutely gorgeous, beautiful water. The interesting part is that when you have one source, you are also vulnerable to that source. And it could be, we think about resiliency and we think about opportunities to protect that source. It's important we protect it, but it's also important that we understand its vulnerability. Not just from the large events, we think about the Cascadia earthquake, but we also need to think about wildfires and chemical spills and even operational disruptions as well. And so the water utility is very much about resiliency, both at the source and through transmission and distribution. The reality of it is, when I think about EWEB, we are a delivery company. We just so happen that we have an on-demand product, so when you turn the tap, you expect us to deliver. And it's very vital to the community. It's part of the health and welfare of the community. So it has both a what factor to it and a when factor to it. And we have to deliver all the time. When it gets disrupted, people notice, as we notice on the electric side as well. And we'll talk a little bit about the last disruption in December, known as the ice storm. But water, it's very much about resiliency and protecting the source and also understanding that we're vulnerable and how do we address that vulnerability in the future. The electric side has been faced with a number of market challenges. The interesting thing when you think about strategy, and people ask me about strategy and I translate it a lot, I said really strategy has to accomplish two things. One, it has to accomplish and provide you with guidance for the decisions that you need to make. And then number two, it needs to be able to inspire you to act in some way. And you can have very, you know, great strategies. They're well written, 37 pages long, beautiful strategies. But if they don't inspire you to act and they don't help you with your decisions, then they're probably not very useful. When we think about the major decisions we have to make on the electric side, much of it becomes about our resources. Every single resource that EWEB has some major decision to make on it in the next 10 years. So that's a little bit daunting. So to give you a little bit of flavor for what that feels like, it equates to, back of the napkin, I did a quick calculation, about $1.5 billion worth of decisions we have to make on our resources. Almost every single contract, whether it's a relicense, renewal, even our relationship with BPA, our federal source, is up for some type of negotiation. And so our strategy needs to address and prepare us and position us to make those major resource decisions. And so the challenge on the water side being resiliency with our source, the electric side, it's very much about resource decisions and also resiliency, but slightly different in the two utilities. Our portfolio, we're also in the Northwest, I should say, blessed with a very carbon-free resource base. This is, for those of you on the radio, this is a chart showing EWEB's makeup of our generation portfolio. Very much in hydro, almost 77% of our resources hydro. We have a little bit of nuclear, and that's through our relationship with BPA. We have some biomass, wind, other natural gas, and solar. And so these resources, and solar being a very small percentage, that percentage is actually based on generation and not based on connected generation, which it would be slightly higher. It just so happens the sun doesn't shine as much in Eugene as it might in Southern California or even the east side of Oregon. It doesn't mean it doesn't have its place. It certainly does. But it also poses some challenges to the utility as well. Part of the volatility on the electric side in the markets comes from the fact that renewables are becoming a larger and larger share of the Western United States grid. California in December experienced the largest swing in resource that they ever have in their history. 13,000 megawatts shifted over 3 hours. And just to put it in real geek speak, that's 13 gigawatts of power changed in 3 hours. As people came home from work and solar went dark, the swing went from one end of the spectrum to the other. And the volatility that has to come with that from a utilities perspective is we have to back up solar and wind with other types of storable or safer resources, stable resources, excuse me. From a financial perspective, EWEB has made some really good moves and a lot of improvement in the last few years. When I first joined EWEB a few years ago, we had just rate increase after rate increase. And in fact, we had gotten to the point where we felt like we could not do that. Much of that was because of large amounts of debt and things that we had burdened the utility with specifically on the electric side. And we could not continue to do that. We can't continue to do that. The financial picture of EWEB is much improved. We've refinanced or eliminated a number of areas of debt. We have an annual budget, to give you a little bit of perspective, of about $300 million. We looked at our capital plan very precisely. One of the things that I remember when I got to EWEB, I heard a lot of the have-tos. And those of you who've been in large organizations, we have to do this and we have to do that. And it makes people feel like they don't have a choice. And so one of the things I did when I was in engineering was I said, okay, I need to understand what truly have to means and what choose to means. And it was interesting because our capital plan at the time was $400 to $500 million spread over 10 years. And I had to go back and help the utility define what a have to means. And where we classified it was if it had to do with safety, or it had to do with reliability, or it had to do with compliance, things that we were just complied to do based on federal standards. Those were our have to's. Everything else was a choose to. We had to have a reason. We had to be able to justify this with our customers. And as it turns out, about half of what we did was have to. And the other was choose to. And so we really had to look at it and make some hard choices relative to our capital plan as to what was important to our community and what wasn't. I think that's part of the culture challenge that we have within the organization that still needs some additional work to it. And I'll be quite honest, we need to continue that work in a lot of areas of the utility. We're certainly not done. We are financially a lot more stable than we were back in 2012. And we've done some hard work to eliminate cost and eliminate debt where we needed to. But I will not tell you we're done, because we're not. And so we have some further work to do. Just this last year, I'll give you one example. On the electric side, we refinanced, and this is just like you would have with a mortgage. We refinanced $115 million worth of past bond funds that we had. And in that process, with today's rates, we saved $19 million. On the electric side, we refinanced $39 million and saved $5.6 million. Most of those savings occurred over the first 5 to 6 years. Incredible amount of work that went into that, but relatively, if you told me every day we could do that, that would be, and now the bad thing is if you had to do that every day, that means your debt would be just horrendous to begin with. So we don't want to go there. But it was a good financial decision to do that. And now we need to make sure our operating and maintenance and our expenses fall in line with that. We do continue to provide incentives for various things. It's interesting because we'll talk a little bit about history. Conservation is still an incredibly important part of what we do. We also have to balance that with what we call smart growth. When someone said, what's smart growth? I said, well, what's dumb growth? Because you really have to understand what you're dealing with. Our history has been used less and less and less. That was the message. We also have to recognize there are places, especially given that we have, on the electric side, a carbon-free resource, are there opportunities to remove and have a positive environmental impact at the same time when actually you look at one segment, which could be the electric industry, and say there's growth in this area? And so we have to really look at what smart growth means relative to the profile of the load, when it occurs, how it occurs. can we look for opportunities to actually control it? And so there's a balance there that I can answer some further questions on later if needed. That's where electrification comes in and other opportunities. We've actually looked at some industrial processes as well. I came out of an industrial environment. There are some situations where even under heating conditions that you have more control of your process with electric than you would natural gas. So from an efficiency perspective in the operation, there's opportunities there. And that would be where we would call smart growth. If it makes sense to both the customer, if it makes sense to the environment, if it makes sense economically, if it makes sense to the utility, then those are the opportunities that we want to look for. Resiliency is part of both electric and water, and I wanted to explain a little bit about what that looks like. We're not only blessed to have federal resource and a lot of resource in the Northwest, we are also blessed to have some local resources. We've done various exercises with the Northwest Grid where we go through simulations of if the grid went down, what would happen. And EWEB has a process, it's a procedure, we practice this regularly. We go through it, and one of the first things we do is we disconnect from the larger grid until that gets built back up. It's sort of a process where you start at your large generation sources and you work your way out into the distribution and eventually get to a local level. And we do this, and we do this with BPA, and we do it with what's a group called WEC, which coordinates the Western region. And even in the simulation, we call up, we tell them we've disconnected, and we wait. And we continue to wait. And they never call us back, which tells us if the Northwest grid went down, and this is a simulation, this is practice. If the Northwest grid went down, what would we do? We can't just wait. So we have to look at local resources. And we are blessed to have some local resources, whether it be our hydro facilities upriver or some other local ones. We have Cougar, there's federal resource. And part of our resiliency plan has to be, how do we link those local resources with the key distribution points within the critical parts of our territory? We also have to understand prioritization. So understanding what the critical loads are, hospitals, evacuation sites, water. It's amazing how we did an exercise too where we got together with a bunch of other people who thought they were pretty vital to the community, whether it was gas or whether it was hospitals. And we asked them, okay, what do you need to operate? We need electricity. So even these other resources need electricity to operate. And so when we're prioritizing things, we have to look at things like hospitals, communications towers. We have to look at emergency services, water, and equally important, wastewater. The last thing you want to have happen is have your toilets backing up when you have no electricity. And so all of these processes lead us to the three real parts of our resiliency plan. One is local resource. The other is what we call the resilient spine. That's connecting local resources to key distribution points. And the other is the flexibility within our system to be able to make some judgments relative to if we have a limited amount of supply, where does that go? And it's more than likely to those emergency services first. And so that's part of the resiliency plan. Sometimes when you look at resiliency, you have to say it's really hard to make everything rugged. It's hard to, this resilient spine can't be everywhere. And so one of the opportunities that comes out of that, and one example would be there's some pretty critical communications facilities on Blanton Heights. Blanton Heights, from an electrical perspective, is hard to service. It's way up the hill, it's out there, it's kind of on the edge of our territory, especially if you looked at many of our resources being upriver. And so the use of a microgrid, which is a combination of a number of different independent generation sources, which includes potentially solar and storage and other generation options in the future, that has to be able to operate without the grid. And so there are opportunities where we'll have to look and say, if there's critical services, how do we build that into the system? And so it's not just a matter of we can't go through the whole system and just make everything just completely rugged. We have to look at where do we prioritize some of those work and what other opportunities do we have, including microgrids as an option. This is actually a photograph from, I think that was definitely in the South Hills. I'll say that. It was probably, I don't know if it was up off of Blanton. It looks like what?
Fairmount.
The ice storm that occurred in DC. How many people here were actually affected by the ice storm in some way? Just from a percentage-wise, that's actually a little higher than most of the territory. About a third of our customers, I would say, were out of power at some point or another. Now, what that means is about the other two-thirds somehow were affected, because I know if you were like my neighbors, they had a lot of extra visitors that week. And I will tell you one thing that I really believe, and this is a personal belief of mine. In some ways, I believe we are blinded by data if we don't understand the context of data. Because I can tell you, I can give you all kinds of statistics about the storm. I can tell you that normally we have a few hundred phone calls a day. We had 70,000. So how do you handle 70,000 when you're used to 300? Not very well, I'll say that. It was a challenge. We also had 24,000 services, and I don't like that term. I'd rather say 75,000 customers affected by sort of a long-term power outage. We normally have 5 crews working in the field. We had 30. So we had brought in crews from Portland, from the coast. Those of you who work for or have been involved with other utilities, we have mutual aid agreements to where we help each other. We had people come up from Grants Pass and other places. So we had a lot of help. And we called in the help early, which was a lesson learned from a few years ago. But it goes beyond statistics. It's part of being a fundamental part of the community, because I there's so many statistics, whether it was Twitter feeds or whatever, but I can tell you that the stories that come back are the ones that are amazing to me. I got an email from a lady, and I really appreciated this, because her email started out, I'm kind of a get to the point person. Her email started out, said, "I'm going to get right to the point. Turn my mother's power back on now." I appreciated that. Now, the email went on for several more paragraphs, and I was really curious about those several other paragraphs. And so as I read through it, I realized her motivation for getting her mother's power, as if I could just turn it on, by the way. So her motivation for getting her mother's power back on, her mother was driving her nuts, and she wanted to get her back home. She said, "My mother is driving me crazy. I really need to get her back in her own house." Now, I would never have discovered that without reading further and looking past the data. I drive an old 1985 Toyota pickup. It was my mom's truck. It just passed 100,000 miles, which means it's going to live a lot longer than I am. Those things last forever. And I was actually out in the Cal Young area, and I was driving through, and I was looking to determine which houses had power and which didn't. It was kind of an area that we weren't sure about. And as I drove down the street, I noticed the left side of the street, the lights were on, the right side of the street was sort of intermittent, mostly dark. And as I'm driving down the road, I hear this ka-thump, 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 ka-thump. Not the usual ka-thump from the truck, mind you. It was a new ka-thump that I wasn't quite sure of. Does anybody know what I was hearing? I was hearing extension cords going from one side of the street to the other. And as I looked down the street, there were probably hundreds of extension cords going down the street. And it was really a sign of neighbor helping neighbor, which in some of these cases, that's what happens. I had a few extra visitors that week as well. And I'll tell you one more storm story. This is about my dad. My dad was without power for a few days. And I called him up. I knew he was out of power. I had seen the outage map. I knew he was out of power, and I called him up, and I said, "Dad, how are you doing?" He said, "I'm okay." And I said, "Are you out of power?" Now, he's 91 years old, And his response was, well, my refrigerator and my microwave aren't working. Those are the two most important things for him at that time. So his microwave and his refrigerator were not working. So I thought, okay, I took that as I'm out of power. I knew he was out of power anyway. So the next day, kind of in the evening, it was about 8 o'clock at night, I had noticed that that neighborhood was back on. At least I thought it was back on. Wasn't sure. He had talked about a tree falling in the backyard and a few details like that. That doesn't really come out in the data. And I called him back and I said, Dad, is your power back on? His response was, well, my microwave and my refrigerator still aren't working. Now, I instantly went to the place of, well, he must be one of those unusual customers that were, the tree took out the service, and maybe the neighborhood is on, but he's without power. I asked him if he was okay, and he said he was okay. I asked him what he was doing, and he said, I'm reading the paper. 8 o'clock at night, he's reading the paper. So, Dad, are your lights on? Yeah, my lights are on. But his microwave and his refrigerator were not working. This is about translation. This is about looking past the data. And so I said, okay, Dad, I'll come out tomorrow and help you. I'm a little busy at the moment. So I went out the next day. I said, Dad, how you doing? He was doing fine. I said, I'm here to look at your refrigerator. And he said, oh, it's okay, I bought a new one. So things happen beyond the simple statistics. My dad got a new refrigerator out of the ice storm. That's basically what happened in his case. I did go, it was a fuse, just so you know. Turn the fuse back on. The present refrigerator was doing well, and the microwave came back on, and my dad was happy. We do have to look beyond the data, and sometimes without context, data is just data, and we really need to look at the context of the data in order to be able to translate that into something useful, into something that we can deem as information. Oh, here's all the statistics, I think. Well, this is water source. So it's interesting about water. We talked about the Mackenzie and what a great source it is. I have a picture of when I was a kid and there's just these fish in the background. Again, my parents told me it was the greatest water in the universe. But it is vulnerable, and so we've looked at the Willamette as another source, and it's a very viable source, by the way. I'm not talking about Wilsonville Willamette. I'm talking more like Salt Creek, if you have a comparison in there. And we've done a lot of testing of the water. And I have to tell you, as the general manager, I do go out and I talk to groups, and I get in trouble either way. If I say the water's not good enough, then it's like, well, it's a viable source. And if I say it's too good, it's like, no, we still need to treat it. So it's good water, but it's not like pure, complete drink out of the river water. So it looks like it's going to be a great source. As a potential second source for the city of Eugene and really the whole metro area. We do have a situation where water in the summer in particular, limited amount of storage. Just to give you a little bit of idea, last summer during our peak season, we used 50 million gallons of water a day. Our source, our need for water continues to grow as the community grows, but we do need a second source, and we're in the process of testing and evaluating and looking at what that source will do and how that source will operate and to what level we will operate, and that's really where we're at in the plannings for the second source. Everybody seems to be interested in property these days. I just have to read this to make sure I know what I'm supposed to say. The riverfront property has been going. We first started with the master plan in 2003 when we declared it surplus. I would describe to people, I don't know of a really great city without a great riverfront. And I think there's a tremendous opportunity to develop the riverfront for the good of the community. It's something that I'm working on with the city and with others to get this developed, to get this in a position where we can get it developed. I think it's a great opportunity, and it's one that I'm trying to push forward. As some of you know, I've also been looking at the headquarters building that we have. And the evaluation shows that, and I really would equate this more to how we use our assets as a utility and how we operate as a utility. We invested in a new facility out on Roosevelt that was opened in 2010. And I have to tell you, I got to eWeb in June, and I had this beautiful view of the river. And in 2 months later, they moved me to Roosevelt. They didn't tell me that when they hired me. So I went from downtown to West Eugene within a couple months. But we invested in this facility, and we invested roughly $80 million. And it's not fully utilized. And part of my job is to make sure that we're using our assets for the good of the community. And so I've looked at how we operate. We don't need two facilities. The key is what kind of customer service presence do we need downtown? Do we need to be near the bus station? What kind of services do we need to provide? We're going to evaluate that to decide if or how much presence we need downtown for customers. But beyond that, the most expensive thing we can do is operate like we are now. Of which we do need to consolidate. We need to save that money. We need to use our resources more efficiently and more effectively. And that, whether that happens over a year or over a few years will depend on the practical aspect of how quickly we can do that. But that's the intent, is to consolidate our operation at Roosevelt. And so that's something that's really high on our list as far as becoming more efficient and more effective. I just said that. This is an event that's taking place today. It's kind of an interesting lesson in Eugene history. eWeb has been at that site for roughly 100 years. Apparently that's not long enough, because Wiley was there first. Wiley Griffin was, this is Black History Month, and so he was the first black landowner in Eugene, and he owned the property of which, part of which eWeb is on now. It's probably pretty close to right where the viaduct goes through the eWeb property, and this is a monument kind of honoring his presence in Eugene. He was really the first version of LTD. He had and operated you can see it there, the donkey with the rail car that went from Eugene up into the University District. And so really part of Eugene's history, and it's important for us to understand our history. After being part of Eugene and leaving for roughly 20 years and coming back to Eugene, I really appreciate the legacy of this community and the people and the events that have been a part of it. And so this event is taking place this evening at eWeb. So one of the things that I'm asked pretty regularly is what's next. As I mentioned at the very beginning, I really do believe that from a strategic perspective, we have to look at the large decisions we need to make and how we make them. A part of that is customer confidence. And those of you who have been in competitive industries in particular, I come out of very competitive industries. And one of the things that I recognize and that is part of the culture is that we need to help and develop our relationship with our customers. We have to have customer confidence. No matter what we're going to ask of our customers in the future, whether that be to just pay their bill like they do today, or support us or help with resiliency or whatever, customer confidence is critical to everything. Part of value gets back to customer confidence. And value, we're really looking at value as what do we provide versus what do you have to pay for it? And that's a relationship. That's a ratio or an equation, if you want to look at it scientifically. Cost is of incredible importance in that equation. If you look at it, what drives the cost of water and the cost of electricity relative to the benefits that you get out of it? Basically, electricity, an electron is kind of an electron. And so what we need to make sure we do is that you get the value out of that electron. So we need to do it reliably. We need to do it safely, and we need to do it affordably. Those are the big three. I'll tell you, there's a lot of other things. And when I talk about distraction, there's a lot of other distractions. But in water and electricity, safety, reliability, and affordability are the big three. And we have work to do. We have to focus on that. We have to work on that. There's a lot of things that go into that, but customer confidence is incredibly important. One of the analogies I use is the 72 Ford Pinto. you remember the 72 Ford Pinto? Do you remember that one? By the way, if you didn't, that was the car that if it got hit from behind, it blew up. Ford actually fixed the problem a few years later. The 72 Ford Pinto, or the Ford Pinto never recovered, partly because customer confidence was destroyed. If we're going to ask our community to accept a second source, then customer confidence is part of that. They have to know we're doing it well, we're doing it correctly. Everything we do relates to customer confidence, whether it be pricing or how we relate to the public, how easy we are to deal with. We've got a lot of work to do there. We complicate everything. I will tell you this. I worked for the parent company that owns Tektronix, by the way. That's the only way I would describe it. If you're an investor, you probably know it, but other than that, it's something that nobody knows. I dealt with hundreds of companies. EWEB is the most complex entity I have ever worked with. We can take something very simple and we can make it complex. And there's a reason. I finally figured this out. We try to cover every single thing in our processes and our procedures that has ever happened in the history of the utility industry or will ever potentially happen in the future. And we codify that into our processes and our procedures. I'm not even talking about the 80-20 rule. I'm talking about the 99.1%, 0.1% rule. And some of it is because we don't trust our own judgment to handle the 0.1%. We need to simplify. We need to streamline in an effort to make us easier to deal with it and more affordable. It sounds pretty simple, but it's incredibly important. And it's where a lot of our early work over the next few years is going to be. It'll never be done. But if we want customer confidence, that's where we begin. And that's where we are going to begin. I think I'm almost out of time. Am I out of time? I guess I am out of time. So.
Thank you.
All right, folks. So what's coming up next is I will have you discuss some questions, and you can come to the microphone. So how about 5 minutes and come back with your questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the February 17th City Club of Eugene program, Finding True North on EWEB's Compass, EWEB's present and future. Support for City Club of Eugene is by members and sponsors, including the AARP of Oregon, keeping Oregonians informed, engaged, and active, and PAC Info. It provides fast, friendly, and reliable internet solutions, saving Lane County since 1980. Now we are going to be doing a segment of member questions. So we have some time for a few questions, and we may have more time if you keep your questions to a minimum and no longer statements. I think I have somebody who's going to help me police that, but we'll see what happens. So with that in mind, go ahead, sir.
I'm Jerry Smith, City Club member. My question is about your current plant on the river. I personally hope that the city will come there and use it for City Hall. But for years, you've had that big empty field there, and we've had a critical problem of people with no shelter. And I wish it would be used as several campsites, carefully supervised campsites for homeless people. Is that possible?
Well, you started off with a really easy question, didn't you? It is surplus property, and I think that there's always opportunities for surplus property. Right now, my intention is pretty simple, and that's to sell it to the city. From an EWEB's perspective, and I'll really try to keep my answers to EWEB's perspective, we have to focus on getting better at delivering electricity and water. And as much as I would like to personally get involved in a lot of other things like that right now, some of these things that I'm working on, such as working with the city on the riverfront property and consolidating operation, is really about focusing the utility on doing a better job of delivering water and electricity. There are opportunities to look at other places for shelter. The city manager and I have talked about some alternate locations. EWEB owns a number of pieces of property throughout the area, and we've had some discussions about looking at those as potential opportunities. So, yeah, Jerry, I appreciate the question. John Reese and I are having some discussions on potentially other locations, but the riverfront is not included in that particular aspect of it. But thank you for the question.
All right, next question.
Ruth Damler, City Club member. A year ago, I'm not sure the exact date, we had the former manager of EWEB come and speak, and many of us are very concerned about the huge carbon emissions and the particulate matter that comes from the Seneca plant. Mm-hmm. And he said that he would not renew the contract if it came up again. And I was wondering what your position is on that. And many of us are concerned about the high asthma rate that's downwind from the plant, and we don't consider it a renewable source. But I know with the new EPA, that might change. So that'll be a different attitude. And I was wondering how that would influence you, and also what your position is about renewing the contract.
So first of all, when I mentioned that there were a number of contracts and things that we needed to look on the resource side, Seneca is one of those contracts. And if I remember right, it's about 10 years out, or it's within the 10-year window. There's really three things that I would like to put into all the decisions we make. We do have to look at it economically, we have to look at it environmentally, and we have to look at it socially, kind of the big three. And if it doesn't make sense to our community, then we would not renew the contract. What I know about the contract right now, from EWEB's perspective, is economically even, it's not a great contract.
Secret.
It's not very good from an economic perspective. Without doing a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking on at the time, if I had to choose of what was on the table, and if that was on the table today, I would say no.
Okay,
we're ready for the next person. Thank you.
Not quite.
Next person.
Yeah, I'm Jack Dresser. I was a member of the group that was adamantly opposed to the whole Smart Meter project a couple years ago, and which, as I recall, involved a $26 million loan, or would have. So in view of your interest in reducing debt and your interest in increasing customer confidence, I wondered what the status of that whole project is now.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's received a number of names, anything from smart meters to AMI, which stands for Automated Metering Infrastructure, and a number of other terms. I guess I have a little bit different view of technology. I don't look at technology and think it's great by itself. I've been involved in technology fields, and for the most part, I believe technology is all about what you do with it, not the technology itself. What's interesting about EWEB is we moved from an opt-out, what was called opt-out process, to an opt-in process. I would say that most of the people within the utility didn't like it when we did that. I loved it. And the reason that I loved it was it gets us back to the basics of why we're here. We're here to help customers in the community, and it has to be about the technology and how we use the technology and what benefits we get out of it. I also like opt-in from the standpoint. Opt-out to me seems more like we're the utility, and you'll get what you'll get, and you'll like it. To me, that's sort of old thinking. I would rather look at the products and services that we need to provide, understand the benefits of what those provide, and if technology is a part of that, then customers will accept it or not. And so I take a much different approach to things like AMI. We do have some of the technology deployed in the field where we can actually test to see what some of those benefits are. It's one thing to go out and say, oh, we think this benefit is there, It's another one to actually go out and show that it's there and then realize and say, okay, yes, it's there or not, it's there. And I think we need to be really honest with everyone in the community when we see benefit and when we don't. So we've done some work on the technology, just to answer your question directly. We do have some pilot meters out there that we're testing, but ultimately this is going to come back to what we offer the community and what they're willing to pay for it, and therefore I do like opt-in.
Right. Next question.
Kevin Shanley.
Hi, Kevin.
Frank, thank you. The new economy of the century is information, and at one time you have looked into providing fiber to the community. Mm-hmm. Is that in your business plan now, and can you just talk a little bit about that?
It's a great question because it's very relevant. Actually, Dick Helgeson was involved in a conversation with our board this past meeting. Yes and no. How's that for an answer? Right to the point. Part of what we bring to the community is we have an investment in assets. And part of the assets that we've invested in through the years has been fiber optic cable. I really think it's a shame if we can't leverage the assets that we bring to the community for the good of the community. For that reason, we've developed relationships with the school district, with the university, Lane County, and other groups that service the community to have access to that fiber and use the fiber for the good of the community. There's another project going on downtown right now where the city of Eugene has paid for some fiber. E-Web is installing that fiber in the duct system throughout the downtown core. And then we would operate and work with other internet ISPs to provide services downtown. We have to be careful, again, as a utility, if we're going to move beyond the, okay, we'll share our assets to, that's a business plan that we want to create. I'll tell you that the communications and the telecommunications business is a much different business than the water and electric business. And I do worry that it's something that will distract from our core mission, which is the safe, reliable, and affordable electric and water. There's also others that do it, and it's a very competitive market. And today, we are not ready for that level of competition. So I need to be really careful about if we want to go that direction, what that would look like.
All right, next question.
Paul Thompson, a City Club member for some time. I guess we were interested in a paradigm that you tossed out in your presentation that had to do with the decision-making process, abandoning the 99.9 versus 0.1 decision-making process for something that was a little more, assumed a little more risk, if you will. It takes management courage, of course, to do that. But I wonder if you could provide us with your favorite example of where you've applied that and where it's worked.
So, great question.
Or hasn't.
Hasn't worked. I'll give you one example, and it's in process of being changed. I can't say that it's where I want it to be yet. When I got together with one of our engineering groups, they were looking at the processes we used for temporary services. So this is where there would be a construction project that needed some temporary electricity or something that would help facilitate the development. And we mapped out what that process would look like. And we basically took over a full whiteboard, and it had something like 28 steps in it. In the middle, there was this one step called do the work. So we had created all of these steps that involved all of these different departments, and this one sending something over here, and this person checks this, and that person checks that. The only one that made a difference to the customer was the one called do the work. And so our process had to go back and look at those other 27. Which of those are necessary? Which both create or eliminate risk? And find a way to say, are those really necessary, and how can we change that process to accomplish what the customer needs and at the same time protect our risk for the other customers? And that was one where we had to make some changes. There are a lot of others, but I'll stick with that one for now.
We have time to two more questions.
Yeah, we only have so much time. I'll get to that.
Hi, James Barber, Springfield City Club member. A question from the table is, regarding the plume of waste such as creosote coming from International Paper at the McKenzie River, is it possible to move that intake upstream of that?
It is possible. However, it would be very expensive. The other thing that we've looked at, source protection is important. This really does get back to source protection. We also recognize that while we love our rivers, and our rivers are, we're incredibly blessed with both the McKenzie and the Willamette, actually, not just the quality, but the volume, and really the stability of the volume is another thing. We also do have a treatment process, and we can't control, we can't buy the whole river. It is possible to move some of that. I would say it would be millions and millions of dollars, of which the product that comes out the other side, out of the treatment plant, would not change. The treatment processes that we use create incredibly safe and pure water, and while it could be possible, I'm not sure it would be practical.
All right, one last question.
Linda Jensen, City Club member. Our table was interested in having you elaborate a little bit more on the what you looked at in terms of secondary water supply. I know that there are like springs in the Cascades and stuff that it might be better water quality and would not be susceptible to a lot of problems that there are with an open water system. And if you could elaborate a little bit more on how you decide all that.
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a lot of things that go into selecting a water source. Water rights is one thing that plays a huge role in it. Oregon actually does a really good job of mitigating and legislating water rights and enforcing those water rights. If you want a comparison, just go down to California, where it seems like the deepest well wins. We did look at a number of sources when we were thinking about a second source. Now, we have water rights on the McKenzie and the Willamette. The Willamette River dates back really to the early 1900s. It's a water right that is very superior over any others that we have, I believe. We have plenty of water rights on the McKenzie. So from a water rights perspective, we have both Willamette and McKenzie. We also have to balance that with the amount of volume that those water rights allow us to have and what we would need. We did look for backup, for example, at well sites. And well sites there are some available. Those of you from Springfield, when you deal with a well in the state of Oregon, even if you have the water right, you have that water right up until it impinges on someone else's water right that might be senior to yours. And so when we looked at a backup and we have several wells that we used in the north area of Eugene, looking at as an alternate, we could not get more than a few million gallons a day out of those without impinging on someone else's water right. And so truly, if we need 10, 15, 20 million gallons a day for resiliency purposes, looking at some of the other sources just would not give us the volume that the community would need to satisfy our needs. Going further up into the McKenzie would also pose some different problems that right now are adjudicated through the water rights in the state of Oregon. So water rights play a big role in the answer to your question, but also trying to balance quality and volume at the same time. We do use 50 million gallons a day in the summer, which is not something that you can just throw a pipe in the ground and say, okay, here we go.
So. And now please join me in giving a big round of applause to our guest, Frank.
Thank you. What? One more thing? Just I wanted to thank everybody for coming out and thank the City Club for the invitation. Maybe you'll invite me back someday when I really know what I'm doing. I'd appreciate that. I really am excited to be back in Eugene. It's an important thing that we do at eWeb. Water and electricity are vital services, and we appreciate your feedback as well. And I'll stick around for a while and answer any questions I can to the best of my ability, and I'm really honored to serve the city in the capacity that I now have. So thank you for inviting me.
And with that, my name is Juan Carlos Valle. This concludes today's program.